thanks, Tom and Veronica and Xi, for asking me to talk. And actually, Tom gave me a rather constraining task. Talk about whatever you like, in however format you like, for however long you like. Okay, so the last one is a bit of a stretch and perhaps just my interpretation. But okay, so this is in the context of the gravitational holography program, and so naturally we're talking about something related to gravity and holography. And so the topic that I've been interested in the last, few years or so now, is the question of what is the structure of quantum gravity in asymptotically flat space, and in particular, does it have a holographic nature? Now, this is a very challenging question, and people have thought about it for a long time. So what I will do in the next hour or so, or however long I decide to talk, will be from the perspective of what's called celestial amplitudes, and I will study their properties in order to infer what they might teach us about the structure of quantum gravity in asymptotically flat space. Now, this has a rather long history, and as I go along in the talk, I will give you some backstory that comes from the question of what are the asymptotic symmetries of asymptotically flat space, how is this related to other aspects of the infrared physics of gravity, which is related to soft theorems in quantum field theory, and more recently has been also related to memory effects. Okay, so the first thing that we should do if we want to learn about the structure of quantum gravity in asymptotically flat space is to start with a Penrose diagram, the causal structure of the space-time. So let me start with that. Okay, so here we start with negative past time-like infinity and future time-like infinity. Over here, spatial infinity. And then this boundary here is the past null infinity and past future infinity. So this is the place where time-like trajectories start and end. This is the place where constant time slices reach. And this is the place where massless particles go. And so one question that one can ask oneself first is, what is the boundary of asymptotically flat space that would serve as the holographic screen? And the natural holographic screen would be provided by the conformal boundary of asymptotically flat space. So null infinity is given by a line times a sphere at null infinity, which got the name celestial sphere. And this is the place where massless particles cross. A useful coordinate system for talking about the structure near the boundary of the spacetime is by using retarded or advanced coordinates. So let me start writing a metric here. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to use, instead of the usual angles theta and phi, I'm going to use coordinates z and z bar, where this gamma z bar is just the unit round metric on the sphere. So that's just Minkowski space in these coordinates. And I do think that I'm minus u. Okay, so if you want to talk about the asymptotic structure of this spacetime, this is just the exact Minkowski space, but there are subleading terms in the expansion near the boundary in null infinity. And in particular, this subleading expansion, what people have used in the past when talking about the asymptotic structure of this spacetime, is Bondi coordinates and Bondi gauge. Where very prominently we will later see is this guy here, which is called the gravitational data, which is free. And then there are a couple of cross terms, where this capital D here is the covariant derivative on the sphere. And then there are further subleading corrections. Conjugate terms, plus dot, dot, dot. So there's some complicated asymptotic structures and boundary conditions that one can impose. And I'm going to focus on particular properties of this
subunit. How are you distinguishing, and maybe I can't read it right, the two different DUDZ terms? Why do you split them?
Just because this is subleading.
So the other quantities only depend on Z and Z bar?
So this can depend on U, Z, Z bar, this as well, this too.
But not R.
So we're just giving the first correction to this term, well, the first subleading term, then the first subleading term in UZ, and then the further subleading term.
And the Minkowski metric, did you write what you meant to write?
In the first line?
Yeah.
Yes, except for a factor of 2 here.
That's not what I was getting at. I thought I would have expected just du dv. Why is there also a du squared? Is this just Minkowski space and standard?
I'm sorry, this should be a dr. Yeah. This is a bad handwriting.
Okay.
My hands tend to cramp when I write on the blackboard, so some things might not look recognizable. So thanks for paying attention and pointing this out. Okay, so this is the asymptotic structure and the causal structure of Minkowski space. And so the first question that you want to ask is, if you're interested in if there's a holographic structure in the spacetime, is what are the symmetries of the spacetime? So this is a question that Bondi, van der Broek, Metz, and Sachs asked in the 60s. And I'm not sure if you can read this over here, but let me go through it. So in the 60s, they asked, what is the asymptotic symmetry group of general relativity? Now, since at large distances, fields become weak and the curvature becomes small, they expect to recover the Poincaré group. But to their great surprise, by imposing these boundary conditions and working in a certain gauge, what they found was an infinite dimensional extension of the Poincaré group. And this infinite dimensional extension has now become known as the VMS group. So what gets extended is the usual global translations in time and space get extended to an infinite dimensional angle-dependent set of translations, which are called supertranslations. And a way to characterize them is by saying that the action of the supertranslation produces a shift in this gravitational data, that's written over here, the ZZZ, which is characterized by a function f, that's an arbitrary function of the sphere angles. So because this is an arbitrary function, there are now infinitely many translations that you can do that act on every point at the celestial sphere independently. And then from this, people have argued that now you can construct an infinite set of conserved charges that go beyond the usual momentum conservation, and in particular depend on this arbitrary function f. A little while later, in 2003 and 2009, differently by De Boer and Solodukin, and then by Banff and Chaussard, they further studied the structure of asymptotically flat space, and they conjectured that we should also extend rotations to superrotations. And they can be characterized by a shift in the data that is now given by a vector field y, that's again an arbitrary function of the angles. And then from that, one can go and construct a conserved superrotation charge, which now depends on this arbitrary rotation vector field y. Now, surprisingly, a little later only, was it discovered that gauge theory also has large gauge symmetries, and you can also construct charges that are now infinitely dimensionally extended from the global U1 charge conservation. And the characterization here is that the shift in the vector field is given by a parameter, a residual gauge parameter epsilon, that's an arbitrary function of the angles. Okay, so that's the story in a nutshell of asymptotic symmetries, where you look at, in the context of gravity, you look at, you impose some boundary conditions, you ask what are the residual gauge symmetries, and then when you find there are residual symmetries that don't fall off at the boundary, you have found the asymptotic symmetry group. Now, around the same time, in the 30s, 40s, 50s, a different set of people asked different questions about the infrared aspects of gauge theory and gravity, and they found that scattering amplitudes have universal factorization properties as you go to very, very low energy. So if you have an endpoint scattering amplitude, and you take the energy of an external massless particle to zero, the amplitude factorizes into an n-1 point amplitude and a soft pole. And this soft pole soft because the energy is taken to zero, takes different guises in a different theories. So, for example, in gauge theory, this order one soft factor in front of the n minus one point amplitude is given by a polarization vector of the gauge field dotted into the momentum vector of any hard particle times the charge, divided by the inner product of the momentum of the kth particle times the momentum that you take soft. So this is a pole in 1 over the energy. Now, in gravity, something similar happens. There, it's called the Weinberg soft graviton theorem, where the leading soft pole has a similar structure, but now the charge of the kth particle, of the kth hard particle, is replaced by another factor of the four momentum. And then, because it was noticed that these soft factors are actually in disguise the word identity of asymptotic symmetries in gauge theory in gravity. So if you look at the asymptotic large U1 gauge symmetry or the BMS supertranslation symmetry, if you look at the word identities, you find that you actually recover the soft theorems for gauge theory and gravity. And then because it was conjectured there should be superrotation symmetries, it was found that there's actually also a subleading soft theorem gravity, which, because the soft expansion is really an expansion energy, starting only with the 1 over energy pole, it has also order 1 terms, and this first order 1 term in gravity is the subleading soft graviton theorem, which has a similar structure, except now the four momentum gets replaced by angular momentum. So this is the momentum space statement of factorization of amplitudes in gauge theory and gravity. Now, if you do a Fourier transform of these theorems, what you recover is the memory effects. So if you transform these poles given in terms of energy and momentum, you recover the kick memory effect in electromagnetism or the displacement and spin memory effect in gravity. And this was perhaps somewhat surprising, but now there are different corners of the infrared, deep infrared of gravity in gauge theory that are actually intimately related. And then to close the loop, it was argued that actually the action of asymptotic symmetries at the boundary should be interpreted as vacuum transition, which are encoded in how fields shift, and this is precisely the statement of memory effects. Now,
is there a version of the sub-soft in the gauge theory side? If you have like a non-abelian gauge theory?
Yeah, so good. So there's also further subleading soft theorems. And these are, I'm just depicting, you know, some. But there are further subleading soft theorems, which have been tried to be related to symmetries. But these are somewhat of a bit different nature than these leading ones in gauge theory and gravity and the subleading one in gravity. I can talk more about that, but it's maybe going a bit beyond. So Campilli and Lada have written down proposals for asymptotic symmetries for this associated to this more subleading soft theorems. But those are a bit less understood.
I was just curious, yeah, so the super rotation doesn't really like have a counterpart.
Oh, the super rotation is related to the subleading soft theorem.
To the gauge theory side. Yeah.
Well, yeah, there is a subleading one, but this is more similar perhaps to the subleading one in gravity. So, okay, maybe let me say this. Here you have the global charge is charge conservation. Then it gets enhanced for this arbitrary function of the angles. Here you have momentum conservation. Here you have angular momentum conservation. And then below that, I mean, we don't have global charges here, but you still can write down something. You can write down some charges here, and these charges can be related to more subleading soft theorems. But it's a bit of a different nature. Yes.
I have a question or comment. So these charges that appear in the U1 case look very similar to the what are called edge modes in the discussion of entropies of subregions.
Yeah.
Is this something that has been made precise some place?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. Have people studied edge modes on general surfaces, not only?
Yeah, mostly in finite surfaces or some finite regions. It looks like there are edge modes for the whole Minkowski space.
Yeah, that's a very good point. I don't think it has been.
One thing that looks different is the role of the antipodal map in the discussion.
Is there an equivalent in the Edgemont story?
Yeah.
So this sounds very, very similar and related, but I'm not aware that anybody has made a clear statement about what the relation is.
Maybe I should emphasize, so the relationship is that in the Edgemont discussion there are some central terms, so terms that commute with everything else, and they have exactly this form, so similar to the idea that there are these conserved charges. Anyway, just a comment.
Thanks, that's a great comment.
To get the super rotations, don't you have to relax the smoothness on the sphere and allow singular points or something?
Yeah, so when people talk about super rotations, they include vector fields y that are single on the sphere. So for example, vector fields that are like 1 over z minus w, where z and w are coordinates on the sphere. There's also a story about DFS tools. And I should say that the whole story about super rotations or DFS tools, I think, is not fully understood. You have to enlarge the phase space. So I think there's still some things to be settled.
Do super rotations also exist in higher dimensions?
So soft theorems exist in any dimension. So if this is really a true equality of different aspects of IR physics, then there should exist high-dimensional or lower-dimensional asymptotic symmetries. For the leading ones, they have been worked out in even and odd dimensions for gauge theory. They have been worked out in even dimensions for gravity. Odd dimensions are a bit of a funny business because there are non-local stuff going on. I think this has been done for even dimensions for the BMS super translations. So I think this would be more difficult. Sorry, but I should go back and check. So maybe I should have said in the beginning, I'm going to focus on 4D physics. Because of this, because in quantum, these properties of quantum field theory exist in any dimensions, there could be some analog story for the other corners. I should say maybe that memory effects, the way memory effects manifest themselves, it depends a bit in what coordinates you work and in what gauge, because you look at particular subleading component and the expansion and so on. So in higher dimensions, for example, they seem to be more subleading than in 4 dimensions. So yeah, I think one has to work it out and see what the relations are. Okay. And I should say maybe I think that this topic is maybe a bit orthogonal to many of the other things that have been discussed in the gravitational holography program. So I'm going to try to give a bit of a pedagogical introduction to some of the aspects here. And I welcome every interruption, comment, complaint, or question for this matter. Since I was asked to choose the format, I encourage very much discussion at every point here. Okay, so this was just to give a bit of a backstory. One could give like whole series of talks on that topic by itself, but what I want to focus on is some aspects of these celestial amplitudes. And so let me maybe now start with the outline. So what I want to explain or motivate is the statement that the four-dimensional S matrix takes the form of a two-dimensional correlator. This was pointed out in work by Bastiaski, Schaus, Frominger, in particular, Jan Mills theory. By Stieber and Taylor, they looked at gravity and string amplitudes. The next point that I want to address is what are conformal primaries in this context, which are labeled by Belt and Jay, which I will explain where it comes from, which was first addressed in a paper by Bastiaski and Shaw, and then with Laura Denis and Andy Strominger. And then there's upcoming work, a series of upcoming works together with Laura Denis and Sabrina Bastiaski on some puzzles regarding conformal primaries, which are supposed to be the building blocks for these correlators in this putative celestial CFD. I want to talk about these universal factorization properties of amplitudes from the perspective the celestial CFT, which will then go under the name of conformal soft theorems. And I will discuss this in the context of gauge theory, which has first been worked out by Fan, Fotopoulos, Taylor, then Nandan, Schreiber, Volovich, and Slotnikov, and Petra, Clario, and Strominger, and then do this for gravity, where it's a bit more puzzling, which has been done independently by Adamo, Mason, Sharma, myself, and Guevara. And I will mention some other works along the way. So let's start with the S matrix. Okay, so we draw again Minkowski space. There's some incoming particles. And I will focus entirely on massless scattering for the purpose of this talk. So there's some incoming and some outgoing guys. And I can write down a scattering amplitude, which is labeled by the four momentum of the particle, which I will write as the energy times a null vector. And this null vector will depend on this point on the celestial sphere where the particle exits, which I will denote by W and W bar. And then if the particles have spin, there's some helicity. And let me put some label K for all the particles involved. And so the statement is that this can be recast as a correlator when you insert operators on the celestial sphere at null infinity at certain points, zk, zk bar. This is now a two-dimensional correlator. And this operator is labeled by delta and j. And where do these labels come from? So here we have four-dimensional Lorentz symmetry. So that's SO1,3 or SL2z. And the action of the Lorentz group on the celestial sphere at null infinity is the global conformal group. So so what it does is it takes this point z, az plus b, az plus d, with ab minus bc being 1. Okay, so then this delta k and jk are just the labels under the global conformal group, the scaling dimension, and the spin. Or I can write them also in terms of chiral weights, hh bar, like this. And h minus h bar. Okay, and then it was conjectured because of the existence of superrotation and the subleading soft graviton theorem that this global conformal group gets actually enhanced to a local conformal group. And that has created a lot of excitement. And so now let me talk a bit about the building blocks here. So usually when we talk about scattering amplitudes, we like to work in a momentum basis, and we use plane waves as the wave functions because they're simple, and also they manifestly have translation symmetry. So wave functions of this form. And let me write them in terms of omega and q. And So how is the statement that the S matrix takes the form of a correlator, how is this incorporated? So the way this is incorporated is by simple basis change. So here I'm working in a momentum basis. In order to make conformal properties manifest, I need to go to a basis where conformal properties are manifest. So very originally, let me call this the conformal basis. And the way this works is by performing on the plane wave amplitudes and the scattering amplitudes, a so-called Mellin transform. So what's that? In this context, it's an integral transform that integrates over energy from 0 to infinity with this particular function. And so when you take this Mellin transform of a plane wave, what it becomes in this new basis is a function of the dimensions delta and this particular expression, minus q dot x to the power delta, where x is the space-time vector. Okay, so there's a possibility that q dot x is 0. So in order to make this integral conversion, I should add this little factor here with an epsilon. And what this corresponds to in the conformal basis is an I epsilon prescription for this denominator. And the minus plus here is correlated with the fact that you have either ingoing or outcoming wave functions. OK, so that's for the building blocks. So plane waves, the Mellin transform of those, give you these expressions, which are the building blocks of the conformal basis, and which make up these correlation functions. So this was just for one plane wave. Now I can do this for a whole scattering amplitude, which depends on the energies and the momenta of many particles. And I have chosen to write this here in terms of the points, maybe I should have written here Z, of this null vector that crosses the, that hits the celestial sphere. So these amplitudes are functions of the energies, the helicities, and these coordinates Z and Z bar. And now the statement is that if you have such an endpoint amplitude, you should do a Mellin transform on all of the external particles. So there will be n of these integrals. And then what you get at the end of the day, let me denote this, note this by A tilde, is an amplitude that now depends on these deltas. And you can show that they transform as correlation functions in a 2D theory, where these deltas correspond to the scaling dimensions under the global conformal group.
What was the delta on the left-hand side?
The delta comes in through this integral transform. There was no delta on the left-hand side. So the point is here you have a basis, a momentum basis. So the labels are the energy and the three momenta and the helicities. Now you integrate it over the energy, so the energy is gone.
Right.
And then the way the conformal dimension comes in is via this integral transform.
So what determines what is the value of delta?
Good. Nothing a priori. So a priori, this is not determined. Only the spin is determined. So only the difference of the chiral weights is determined, because you pick whatever scattering amplitude you want. But I will tell you in a second how this delta is actually constrained.
Does this work in any sense in higher dimensions?
I mean, you can take integral transforms.
So the story basically goes through.
I don't know that. The short answer is I don't know if people have looked into this. But it's an interesting question.
Are you assuming anything about the theory itself, other than that there's massless particles? It could be GR or it could be any.
Yeah, it could be, sorry, yeah, I should have said, this is for a general set of theories like in Mills or gravity, Einstein gravity, string theory. You can also do this for tree-level string amplitudes, which was done in this paper here. So they started with, let's say a four-point string amplitude, do this Mellin transform, and then you get a two-dimensional correlation function with certain conformal weights.
I mean, at this point, what could go wrong? You just get a function now of the Mellin conjugate variable and the, three-sphere, four-sphere, higher-dimensional sphere. What one might worry about? There's a question of invertibility of the Mellin transformation.
Yes, that's a very good point.
But I don't know how that comes into this.
So in view of being a bit more pedagogic, I'm sketching things here. Yes, there are conditions on these deltas for the Mellin transform to be invertible, in particular on the real part of delta. I didn't want to go into that, but those are all very fascinating aspects. And the puzzles that I'm going to end the talk with are related with all kinds of subtleties that one has to be very careful about. So there is this the convergence issue of Mellin amplitudes, the invertibility. Another thing that will come up is you have to be very careful about distributions. So there's contact terms all over the place. So there's lots of subtleties. And here I'm just giving you the bullet points, so to say.
Is there some relation between this Mellin transform and the one that's usually used in CFDs?
Well, the tools are the same.
But is there some of the more
detailed? I think there should.
In particular, a long time ago, we looked at the large R limit of amplitudes using Mellin transforms, and we got expressions that sort of look like this. So actually, I suspect there might be a connection. Again, when you take the large ADS radius.
Yeah. Then people recover the usual flat space amplitudes of whatever theory. Yeah.
Well, yeah, it's an approach to going after that.
But is the Mellin transform that's taken there the same as this one?
Yeah, I should check. But I mean, it looks, well, there's some similarity, but I don't remember.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting question. Like here, we're really like just beginning to explore what are all the building blocks, what are the rules, and thus the results that you get when you look at the properties of whatever you're interested in the bulk, do the properties that you get after transforming to the conformal basis, do they look like anything we know in CFD?
So far, you're just having right about transformation properties, but not whether this is like a correlation function of a unitary CFT or anything like that.
Yeah, so, I mean, I could write it out, but we could do an example. We could take, say, a four-point gluon amplitude, MHB gluon amplitude in Young-Mills theory, do the Mellin transform. One thing that you do in order to perform this is you massage the four-dimensional energy momentum conserving delta function in such a way that you can easily perform these integrals. And then what you end up is some expression, which looks like something like Z12 to something, Z23 something, and so on. And what's up here is you then say, OK, this looks like a correlator, a two-dimensional correlation function, whose exponents, where these exponents here are related to this conformal dimensions delta. So you will start with some amplitude. You integrate all the energies of the external particles. You get in delta for each particle. Then you get some expression that looks like one over, let's do a three-point function. No? You get a structure like this. Da-da-da-da. And you So you get a structure like this, and then you read off that whatever is the exponent should be delta 1 plus delta 2 minus delta 3. And so you read off that, the 4.4 gluon amplitude becomes a correlation function in 2D theory, where the four operators in this correlator have a conformal dimension that you just read off by identifying it with a correlation function. So the structure in terms of, so here, you have a function of the omegas, you have some function of the z's and the z-bars. You transform it, and then it will split into some function of z's. Then there's some function of z-bars. And this piece looks like a two-dimensional correlator, and you read off what the exponents are, the conformal weights of the operators involved.
But delta doesn't have to be real in this case.
No, and it isn't.
So it's not a unitary CFT for sure.
I mean, OK, first of all, the only thing that really has to be unitary is the bulk.
Yeah,
and then whatever the boundary theory is, it is. And then if it's a theory that has some nice properties that we can use some techniques to say something back for the bulk, that's OK. Other questions?
Is there an operator product expansion?
Yes. OK, I could add this as another point here. Maybe I should give you the spoiler. If you take collinear limits of amplitudes, when you take the two momenta parallel, what that corresponds to is, let's say, particle I and J, that you take Zi to Zj, and what you will get is, well, poles like this, and you can extract from the collinear limit of the amplitudes when you do a Mellin transform the leading OPE coefficient of two operators in, let's say, Young-Mills theory, or Einstein-Young-Mills theory.
Sorry, is the statement that in the collinear limit you could write, say, the four-point function as a sum of three-point functions, of products of three-point functions?
So what has been done is read off the OPE from the collinear limit. I think there's also some work on doing conformal block expansion in the conformal basis.
Right, I guess it's a separate question as to whether the OPE, whether things converge, as opposed to whether there's an operator product expansion that converges. Maybe. Is that the distinction you're making?
I'm just telling you what has been done. which is take the collinear limit of an amplitude, you can extract the OP. And this has been done only for a few theories, and this is very recent work, like a few months ago. I don't know what to say beyond the statement since, it hasn't been worked out or studied yet.
By the way, one other small question. Are you Mellin transforming the reduced transition matrix element or the S matrix with the momentum conserving delta function?
Oh, the delta functions are there. So here you really take the full amplitude. Let's say this is the stripped amplitude times the momentum conserving delta function.
Okay, so,
and you use that in order to perform some of these Mellin integrals.
Yeah, so which one are you Mellin transforming?
The full.
The full thing.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, so now let me talk about the building blocks of this putative celestial CFT. So I have already told you that plane waves Mellin transform in this particular structure here. And so now we want to talk about asymptotic symmetries and how they are encoded in this celestial CFT, like what generates the asymptotic symmetries from this boundary perspective. And so I should talk about solutions to Maxwell theory and linearized Einstein gravity, at the very least. And this will lead to something that's called conformal primary wave functions. Okay, so I'm interested in solution to Maxwell theory. Box in mu equals zero. In order to write this, I used the Lorentz and radial gauge. This seems to be the good gauge choice in order to make conformal properties manifest in this celestial CFT. On the left-hand side here, would write down exactly this wave function and address it with some polarization vector. The solution to this wave equation, which in this gauge and transforming under the global conformal group with these weights and spin, conformal dimension and spin, have been constructed by Pasterski and Shao by using a hyperbolic slicing of Minkowski space, looking at the bar-to-boundary propagator, doing the embedding space formalism. I will skip all that. I will just give you the solution and motivate it where it comes from. So the solution labeled by conformal dimension and for a given spin takes this form. That's just the same as I wrote here, except with some normalization factor. And now there's also another piece, but this piece is just the total derivative. Okay. So let me call this piece V delta, because this is just the Mellin transform of the usual plane wave. Okay, very good. For linearized gravity, a similar story holds. Again, working in Lorentz and radial gauge. And H is traceless. So here, the only difference is that I have a polarization tensor. And the solution takes a very similar form. Except now, I have a diffeomorphism vector field here, appropriately symmetrized. Okay, so these are the solutions to the wave equations in Maxwell theory and in gravity, linearized gravity, which have the property that they transform under the global conformal group, namely the action of the Lorentz group on the celestial sphere at null infinity, as conformal primaries with dimension delta and spin J. And the spin is, of course, already chosen by whether you look at gauge theory or gravity. And then the question was, how is this conformal dimension, how is it constrained? So it was found by Pasterski and Shao that you get a normalizable basis of wave functions precisely when this conformal dimension is complex, and in particular takes the form 1 plus I times a real number. So what they particularly showed was that if you take these wave functions, which are the Mellin transform of plane waves, and you compute the inner product, some generalization of the Klein-Gordon norm, then this is delta function normalizable. And so it forms a complete delta function normalizable basis. And the condition is that this conformal dimension has to be 1 plus I times some real number. And this is the principal continuous series of the Lorentz group. OK, funny dimensions, but that's what it is.
Real and positive, or just real? Can also be negative there? Imaginary parts? Or?
Yeah, it can also be negative. And in particular, under this inner product, because the Klein-Gordon inner product involves complex conjugation, you will get pairs between guys that have 1 plus I lambda and 1 minus I lambda. Okay. So this is like in the plane wave basis, right? So I could have just written down this for plane waves, and I would get the same answer, except this would be the energies and not these parameters lambda.
The equivalent, right, representations is plus a lambda minus a lambda. So it's usually enough to just one half.
If you include the shadows of the positive ones. So here, you need positive and negative under the inner product. It depends on how many dimensions you are in, whether you're in even or odd, the statement that you made. Let me correct this. If you look at massless scalars, so this is for massless vectors and tensors. If you look at massive scalars, then you only need half of this principal series. For the massless ones, you need the full. And similarly here for gauge theory and gravity. Okay. Other questions? Okay, so now what I want to tell you is how the asymptotic symmetries of asymptotically flat space come out from these two-dimensional conformal primary wave functions. So I will call these conformally soft wave functions, conformal primary wave functions. So we're looking for Goldstone modes that whose action produces large gauge symmetry and BMS super translations. In the energy momentum basis, the soft photons and soft gravitons were obtained by taking the energy to zero. Now we're integrating over energy, so we cannot take the energy to zero. The Mellin transform takes the UV and the IR and mixes all energies. So what we proposed in this paper with Laura and with Andy was that what you should do here, and it becomes obvious once you put the wave functions in the form that I did, that you should take the conformal dimension to a special value, namely 1. And then you can see that the only thing that remains is a total derivative. Similarly, in gravity, when you take delta to 1, the only thing that remains is a diffeomorphism. And then if you look at the z component of this function alpha at null infinity, what you recover is the derivative of a function that's entirely a function of the angles. And if you compare this with what I wrote up here, this is exactly the action of large gauge transformations. So the conformal primary wave function, which I mentioned 1, is precisely the Goldstone mode of spontaneously broken large gauge symmetry. Similarly here, if I look at the z component of this vector field psi at null infinity, then this becomes a particular function of the angles, this function f. And if you compare this with the action of super translations over here, those two agree. So the delta equals to 1 spin 2 conformal primary wave function is precisely the Goldstone mode for spontaneously broken BMS symmetry. OK, great. So now we understand from the perspective of this two-dimensional celestial sphere that certain conformal primary wave functions produce precisely the action of these asymptotic symmetries. And even more so, so you can ask, okay, what's the conserved charge? What's the current? I would also like to relate this to the soft theorems and in scattering amplitude, which here would be a statement about correlation functions. So you can construct a current here, the soft photon current, from this Goldstone mode. So what you do is you take the inner product that I, well, I didn't define it here, but I told you it's a version of the Klein-Gordon norm. You take the inner product of a general quantum field operator, expanded in modes that are these conformal primary wave functions. And this conserved current, if you insert it into correlation function, gives you a factorization property. So this is the conformally soft photon current, whose dimension and spin is 1 and 1, or whose weight is 1,0. And then in gravity, this is a bit more funny. So in order to get the operator that you have to insert into correlation functions to get factorization, you need to construct the BMS current. And the BMS current is not just the same expression here, but you have to take a derivative of the inner product of a general quantum field operator of spin 2 with this Goldstone mode. And the conformal dimension and spin are now 1 or 2. And in terms of the weights, okay, you start with something that has 3 half minus a half, but once you hit it with a derivative, it gets a plus 1 half here. So these are the two currents that you insert into correlation functions to get factorization properties, which I will explain next, unless there's questions about this.
There wasn't JH minus H bar.
Yeah, so here I wrote down, okay, let me do it slowly. So this is the conformal weights of this guy. I want to hit it with the derivative.
Oh, but the delta and the J, you also wrote it for the thing in there. So say you wrote J is equal to 2. That's fine. Okay.
Well, it's a spin 2 guy.
Yeah.
So, yeah. No. Right? 1 plus 2 is 3 divided by 2 is this, and 1 minus 2 divided by 2 is this.
Yeah.
And then I hit it with a derivative. If I pull it down, I get a derivative on that shifts the second guy by 1, so it gets 3 half, comma minus a half plus 1 is. So these are funny weights, but this is sort of an artifact of the feature that supertranslations are kind of like densities, and that's why they have half integer weights instead of integer ones. Okay.
Since I'm intuition, why delta equal 1, besides, okay, you look at the specific solutions, like.
Yeah, maybe I can. So the soft expansion here in the momentum basis is an expansion, right? You have first a pole, then an order one term, and in principle you can write down the expansion, but there are just no universal properties after some order. When you Mellin transform, this expansion gets turned into limits of the conformal dimension. That's not an expansion anymore. So the leading, subleading, etc. soft theorems are now particular values of the conformal dimension. You're not supposed to understand this at this point fully because it hasn't been fully
But then from this point of view,
explained
I guess
yet.
In higher dimensions, I would expect a different value of delta.
Okay, so let me tell you where this comes from. So here, the soft theorems have to do with symmetries, right? So they're Goldstone modes. So here in this basis, you have all the wave functions available, and you ask, what are the Goldstone modes in this basis? And the Goldstone modes, voila, are for delta equals 1 in Gibbs theory, in gravity. And then for gravity, if I have time, I will tell you that there's another Goldstone mode here, which is not apparent from the way I wrote this, but there's another value of delta where you get a Goldstone mode. And then there's just no more. Which leads to another interesting puzzle, but I'm not sure we'll get to it. But yeah, just to summarize a bit, so we have now looked at what is the basis of plane waves in this formulation where conformal symmetry is manifest as opposed to translational symmetry. And we have found that if we look at solutions to our favorite gauge theory and gravity theories, that you get conformal primary wave functions which solve the bulk equations of motions. And moreover, certain limits of it correspond precisely to the Goldstone modes of a spontaneously broken asymptotic symmetries. Okay. So now I have two options. Either I tell you something about memory modes, or I tell you more about how the factorization of correlation functions appears in this conformal basis. No preference?
Factorization.
Good. Thank you. Okay, so in quantum field theory, we have these nice universal theorems that say when amplitude is factorized, and this is universal and puts constraints on amplitudes. So some of this is expected to hold also in this other basis. I mean, after all, we're just doing a basis change, so some structures should survive. But it's not that clear, because when we do the Mellin transform, we integrate all our energy. So UV and IR mix, and so in one basis you have an infrared limit that gives factorization, and then in the new basis, what do you do? Okay, so let me start with gauge theory. Which has been discussed in this set of papers. So let me start by drawing a picture. So we have some amplitude, and then we have some external particle, massless particle, whose energy we take to zero. And the statement of soft factorization is that there is some soft factor here. By zero, I just mean that this is the leading soft factor, and maybe I give it an index, so this is spin one. And then you get the, let's see, the n-1 point amplitude without the soft particle and the soft pole up front. So the way you can understand these amplitudes is by, let's say we take an n-point amplitude, we take the nth energy to zero. And for to be specific, in these papers, Young-Mills theory was studied, so they looked at n-point MHV amplitudes. Take the nth energy to zero of the n-point amplitude multiplied by the nth energy. And then in equations, that's the picture that I drew above, where these amplitudes depend on the energies and the momenta, or as I erased somewhere, we can replace the momenta by the angles z and z bar. And this particular factor takes a very simple form for MHV amplitudes in Young-Mills theory. So this is just given by this ratio. Where what I wrote here, Zij, is just the difference between Zi and Zj. Okay. So that looks very simple. Now what happens in the conformal basis? So there, what we do, we have, a correlation function, we have some operators inserted, and we would like to take one of them to be something special so that we get a factorization. And I told you that something special happens when this conformal dimension delta is taken to 1. So we take delta to 1, or since delta is 1 plus I times some real number, let's call this real number lambda. This corresponds to taking lambda to 0. Okay? And then the question is, does this factorize into something? I put a tilde here, which gives an n-1 point correlator and some soft factor, or conformal soft factor. And indeed, it does. So what you should do is you take this parameter lambda, which is kind of the Mellin dual for the energy, to 0, of the correlation function, a tilde. So this is now the Mellin transformed amplitude. So this is a correlation function. And you will find what I've written above, where now these A tildes depend on lambdas and Z and Z bar as opposed to omega and Z bar. And this guy, this soft factor, turns out to be exactly the same soft factor as in the momentum space factorization. Okay, so this is nice. This factorization just goes through. Maybe this looks a bit trivial, but it is not. So there's various massagings of delta functions and other things involved and integrals that you perform. But at the end of the day, this becomes very simple. This factorization was kind of expected to work because there's a assumed universal property of quantum field theory scattering amplitudes. But it's surprising that it works in this simple way because the Mellin transform entangles the UV and the IR. Okay. Maybe I should say at this point, since this question was raised, there are subleading soft theorems in quantum field theory. And so similarly here in this basis, there's also subleading soft conformally soft factorizations going on for different values of this conformal dimension. But let's stick with the leading case here, since this is already exciting enough. Okay, so now gravity. Gravity is a bit more tricky. Okay, so why is gravity more tricky? So one way to understand why this factorization just works the way it does is by looking at the OPE of the soft photon current, this guy here, with an operator of energy omega. This is something like, so let's say this depends on Z and this depends on W, 1 over Z minus W. If you Mellin transform that statement, you get the OPE with an operator of dimension delta and spin J. Which is also just given by 1 over Z minus W times the operator spin on J and dimension delta. Now, what happens for gravity is something different. So in gravity, if you take this supertranslation current that I defined here, and you compute the OPE with an operator of energy omega, you get an explicit factor of the energy. If you Mellin transform that statement because you're integrating over omegas, this guy will do something special to the OPE. What it does is, so now we are taking the OPE of the supertranslation current with an operator of spin J and dimension delta. And what it does is it shifts the conformal dimension of this operator by 1. Okay, and we have to take this into account when thinking about how this factorization should work. So in the energy momentum basis is very similar than what happened before. You take the nth energy of the nth massless particle to 0. Let me call this now H, the amplitude, just to distinguish it. So spin 2 soft factor, the leading soft factor in this expansion, and minus 1 point amplitude. But this guy is now a bit more complicated, in particular has this extra factor of omega. So there will be an omega. And then, let me just not write this, there's a function of the z's and the z bars.
Delta plus 1, right? Or not, or minus 1?
Here there's no delta yet.
No, the top line.
Yes.
Minus or plus?
Plus.
Plus. Should I think of it as like a descendant or another primary?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Because if it's another primary, I would get nervous that maybe the CFT does not have another primary with delta plus 1, right? But if it's a descendant, then it's fine because you're just acting with some symmetry.
Maybe we can discuss about this because there's a lot that I'm not telling you here, a lot of subtle things that have to do with when you have objects of real dimension, which is of any real dimension. Maybe we take this discussion offline. I cannot answer your question at this point. What I want to tell you is how this is implemented, how the factorization implements this feature. So here I told you the soft factor has an explicit power of the energy of, say, the kth particle, and you sum k from 1 to n in this endpoint amplitude. So the factorization of gravity amplitudes in the conformal basis takes a somewhat funny form. So again, since we should take delta to 1 to get the supertranslation current, or equivalent to lambda to 0, I start the same expression. Now, this is the Mellin transform for graviton amplitude, so it's a 4-graviton n-graviton correlator. And the question is, does this factorize into something that has an n minus 1 point correlator with some soft factor up front? And the statement is that here, this n point correlator depends on all the different lambdas, so lambda 1, lambda k, to lambda n. The feature that the OPE of the supertranslation current shifts the operator in the OPE means that in these lower point amplitudes, I have to have shifted operators. So here I have operators of dimension lambda 1, lambda k, lambda n. In these lower point amplitudes, in order for the correlation function to factorize, I need to shift the kth conformal dimension by 1, or equivalently lambda by I. So this is how this depends on. And once you incorporate this funny feature of the supertranslation current, then you get on the nose that also the endpoint graviton correlators factorize. And this is the celestial version of Weinberg's leading soft graviton theorem. There are more subtleties that I could tell you about in gravity amplitudes. But maybe let me just say that the subleading soft graviton theorem and further subleading ones also lead to factorization of this conformal basis for different values of this conformal dimension, similar to as I told you in the gauge theory case. And so it seems like that much of the structure of scattering amplitudes in four-dimensional asymptotically flat spacetime is inherited by this putative celestial sphere conformal field theory.
Sorry, but weren't the lambdas supposed to be real?
Yes.
So we're not.
Okay, there. So in upcoming work, we're discussing real conformal dimensions. Maybe let me jump to some of the last points that I want to make.
Remind me. So when you made the statement like, oh, it had to be a real, like it's 1 mm-hmm. plus I lambda real, what was the reason why you could mention that it was real in that context? Like what was the...
That was to get a normalizable basis of wave functions.
I see. Mm-hmm. Okay.
It seems, so in these cases, when delta equals 1, this is still within the 1 plus I lambda, right? You just take lambda to 0. But what we found in this paper here was that actually superrotations or the subleadings of graviton is encoded in a conformal primary that has a real conformal dimension, namely 2. And then you ask, okay, how does that work? Is the conformal, the full complete conformal basis not spanned by the conformal primary wave functions whose conformal dimension is 1 plus I times a real number? And so what we're discovering here, which will be out hopefully in a few weeks, is that you can express conformal primary wave functions with real dimensions as a certain contour deformation of conformal primary wave functions on the principal continuous series, which has delta as 1 plus I lambda. And then, so in this sense, the basis is complete and spanned by the ones that have 1 plus I times some real number. But the asymptotic symmetries you see being incorporated by real conformal dimension primaries.
So when you talk about the complete basis, it's complete basis of functions in four-dimensional Minkowski space. Is that correct?
So what I mean is, so if you want to ask here about complete basis, you have to define an inner product with respect to which you make the statement. So before you went to this Mellin transform conformal basis, you had plane wave functions. Those form a complete basis of wave functions, delta function normalizable wave functions. So that statement carries over to this Mellin transform plane waves, which are these Vs that I had erased. But on top of that, the objects that are conformal primers in this theory and obey the bulk equations of motion in this particular gauge, they're not just the plane wave Mellin transforms. They also have these total derivative terms. And these, in particular, limits when the dimension becomes real for certain values of the conformal dimension, you get total derivatives that correspond to Goldstone modes of Broca symmetries. And the statement is, but wait, you had a complete basis already. So what are wave functions that are of this principal series? And what I'm saying is that you can, that the tension is resolved by realizing that these wave functions can actually be written as a Conte integral, as a superposition, if you wish, of wave functions on a principal continuous series. So there is no tension there. This is resolved. And let me just maybe say here, so there is a conformal primary of dimension 2, which is related to the stress tensor. So we have j equals 2 and delta equals to 2. So this gives a 2,0 conformal primary. And you can write the stress tensor. So there's a 2D stress tensor for 4D gravity, which was discussed in a paper by Pedro, Clario, Kapek, and Strominger, maybe Mitra. Where they wrote down a stress tensor, and you can precisely identify that this stress tensor is related to dimension 2 conformal primary in this basis. I don't know if this answered your question.
Also, this is there if theory has gravity, if the four-dimensional theory has gravity, or this stress tensor operator, is it there in pure Young-Mills? Pure Maxwell, or it's only when we have gravitons in the mode?
So this stress tensor is an expression. Okay, maybe let me be a bit, let me sketch this here. So similar as defining this conserved soft photon current and the super translation current here, I can write the stress tensor as defined as the inner product of some quantum field operator H, whose mode expansion is in the principal continuous series. And then put this particular dimension 2 operator, and I shove some stuff under the rack. This particular dimension 2 operator can actually be obtained as the shadow transform of a delta equals to 0 operator, but never mind. So there's a dimension 2 operator, which gives rise to a stress tensor whose insertion into correlation functions or into amplitudes gives the subleading soft graviton theorem. So I'm talking about this guy here. The stress tensor is related to superrotation symmetry or celestial conformal symmetry. So that's the local conformal symmetry. This is related to the subleading soft graviton theorem. And it is encoded in a particular conformal primary in this basis.
I guess, I mean, I think people asked similar questions already, but so should we think of this CFT, 2D CFT, as some theory which has a continuous spectrum of operators, all of which are on the principal series? Is that the right statement?
Mm-hmm. So you have a complete basis with operators spanned with conformal dimension that's continuous.
Yes.
Whose real part is 1 and whose imaginary part is...
So something similar happens in normal CFTs, where you take a four-point function and you can decompose it into a complete basis, which is on the principal series.
Yeah.
And then to get the OPE, you just deform the contour and pick up poles.
Yeah.
And it seems like that's what's going on.
Yes, something very similar is happening
then
here.
I would say that the physical operators aren't on the principal series in this theory. They're in...
No. So in CFT, what you do is you go to the principal continuous series because there's orthogonality relations.
Right.
So that's very useful to do,
right.
But the physical operators have real dimension.
Right.
Here the plane waves, I mean, that's physical, right? And the plane waves correspond to operators that have their weights on the principal continuous series. while the Goldstone modes of spontaneously broken symmetries seem to be directly obtained from objects that have real dimension. And I'm saying here now there's no puzzle here because you can express them in terms of the principal continuous series.
Would you say that there is a state operator correspondence in this theory? Because states, I mean, I'm just trying to say, we know what states are in the bulk. At least, I mean, let's say free, even free theory. We know what states are in the bulk. They're more or less labeled. I mean, there are fog bases, which is labeled by this plane waves, right? So that basically gives you also states on the boundary that are labeled by principal series representations, right?
I guess that's what she's doing, right? She gave you a state operator map.
Well, yeah. I'm just trying to understand how, is it really the precise statement, or is there something... And then I guess this comes to Alex's question. Okay, so now we have these correlation functions that are functions of operators that live on the principal series. Now, if you start bringing them together, mm-hmm. you'll get some singularities. And the question, all of those will still lie on the principal series, or are you telling us that there will be some new singularities? For example, this dimension 2 operator will also pop up. Because there isn't any, at least in the bulk, there isn't any state that corresponds to this 2-0 operator, if I understood you correctly. Because I thought that all your completeness statement was that all states are just spanned by principal series. Right? But it looks like there's some other operators that do not have state corresponding to them.
Well, weren't they the super rotation?
Yeah, so one example was the ones that are not on the principal series, but I told you that they can be expressed in terms of the principal continuous series. So since you asked about the OPE, so let me give you one statement. So if you take, let's say, a spin 1 field with conformal dimension delta 1, and 1 with conformal dimension delta 2, the OPE looks like something like this, delta 1, 2. And then the conformal dimension of this operator is the sum of these two minus 1. And then there's a coefficient here. Which turns out to be the Euler beta function, which is as a function of the, so this is product and ratio of gamma functions with these two arguments. So you see there are some funny things happening in this conformal basis. There are two operators that have dimension delta 1, delta 2, and then in the OPE, you get an operator that has dimension delta 1 plus delta 2 minus 1.
But that leaves us on principal series, right?
With a minus 1, yeah. Yeah, and the sum of the two, if
So then it's like a free theory. Hmm? Should I think of it like a free theory? I mean, some simple relation between the dimensions and stuff.
These OPEs will be corrected once you include loop effects.
Okay. So it's free in the sense
that this is for. So these OPEs have been obtained not by looking at the CFT, but by taking. Scattering amplitudes, let's say tree-level amplitudes, taking the collinear limit where the momentum become equal, which means that Z1 goes to Z2, and then you extract from it the coefficient here.
But the anomalous dimension will be purely imaginary.
Say again?
It'll still lie in the principal series after accounting for loop steps.
It won't be of the form 1 plus I.
Well, here, yes, but in general, I don't know.
If delta 1 and delta 2 both on principal series,
it's
this
also the principal series. It looks a little bit like Liouville theory.
Okay.
Right, where you have vertex operators that live in this continuum of dimension, mm-hmm. c minus 1 over 24 plus a constant.
So for gravity, I think what happens is that you just get an operator of delta 1 plus delta 2. And that one, if the gravitons lay on the principal series, will not lie in it anymore.
But Liouville is a unitary theory.
Yeah, there's an I that doesn't appear in this.
This is a unitary theory. I mean, the bulk theory is unitary, and you have a positive definite inner product. It's just a positive definite inner product with respect to Euclidean conformal group, right? That's what makes it different from.
Yeah.
I still don't understand this.
Dekker is not L minus 1, L minus n.
with respect to that inner product, right?
Yeah, then it's not some other thing.
It's different.
I'm still confused by this 2-0 operator. What can you a little bit explain better what you mean when you say that you can express it in terms of principal series, in terms of some contour deformation of principal series?
Yes, but it would be a bit lengthy. this is coming.
There is some organization.
So, yeah, so you can write down a contour integral over the principal continuous series. In this contour integral will be some functions that have poles. Then when you compute the residue of those poles, you will recover this spin 2 delta equals 2 conformal primary.
Maybe I can just ask you.
I mean, I can show you the.
So what about OPEs of stress tensors, or OPEs?
Yeah. So there is a paper by Fotopoulos and Taylor that looked at the stress tensor OPE with some spin 1 field.
No,
TNT. No, TNT. I cannot say.
J&J, no.
J&J, yes. J&J.
For the U1 gauge theory, right?
Yeah. So. Would be you disappointed, I guess?
So there's no level?
What is the answer?
Yeah. The level is that there's no one over the square term.
Well, what else could it be?
No, but it's a Kac-Moody algebra, so there could have been a level.
No, but the level is a dimensionless number, and there's no dimensionless quantity in the bulk that it can be equal to.
But
either zero or infinity.
The BMS has central extension.
There's no dimensionless.
The BMS, when they compute these super rotation algebras and you allow for things that are not single value in the sphere, you could get central extension. There's a Virasoro.
It either has to be C equals zero or infinity. I don't see any other dimensionless.
No, it's part of the expansion when you're writing down the boundary conditions.
So using Wilson
something that depends on the background.
Okay.
For Young-Mills theory,
yeah.
OPEs have been written down using Wilson lines where you do recover a level.
In a particular background.
Yeah.
Can I ask you a question? What is a two-particle state?
These are all very basic building blocks so far.
So you see why it's a bit confusing, right? Because if single-particle states all like principal series, and naively I would say, okay, two-particle states, I will just add up dimensions. That will take me off principal series.
Yeah.
That doesn't sound correct, right? So,
I mean, there are many funny things going on and many subtle things. There's lots of questions that can be asked, and lots of problems that ask for someone to solve. Okay.
Is there some relation to these library operators?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There is. There was a paper by Shao and Kolova.
Right, yeah.
All right.
Because, yeah, you're at null infinity if you integrate along the null direction. Well, what is the.
There they try to define some CFT that lives on the celestial sphere as well. Or not define, suggest that there might be one. That describes the correlators of those library operators.
Right. But this fits all in the same framework. Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's the 2D celestial sphere, and then what they do, I think, is they look at the BMS algebra as obtained from these library operators. Mm-hmm. But I do not remember everything that they did, so.
Has anybody worked out a conformal block decomposition of some four-point function?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Bolovich and company have worked this out, I think, for spin 1.
And or like free for free spin 1.
Yeah.
And so how does it look like? How many conformal blocks do you get?
I don't remember. I can give you the reference. Another thing that I should say is maybe it's the higher you go in points, the more difficult it is, because you have, so for 4 points you could use, and 3 points you could use this four-dimensional energy momentum conserving delta function for the three or four Mellin integrals that you have to do, but then you go to higher points and you have more integrals and you have to, it becomes much more complicated. Four is fine, but 5 and 6 and 7 becomes more difficult, and it hasn't been worked out for many, it has been worked out for I think 5 to the 4 and for Young Mills, the endpoint amplitudes, but nothing else, as far as I know.
Can I ask about this continuous spectrum? Mm-hmm. So, in the bulk, I might imagine that I have a discrete set of particles or something, not some continuum. I guess there are continuum states that are labeled by the null momenta as the particle heads off towards square plus. So, what exactly is this continuum supposed to correspond to in terms of states in the bulk?
Just energy.
Just energy.
Yeah, in this basis, this corresponds to statement about conformal dimension.
And then the OPE coefficients, if you were to try to do those in some sort of perturbative expansion, would you be able to see that they only depend on the bulk couplings and not on the kinematics?
So the OPE so far has only been worked out for Young Mills and Einstein Young Mills, and for the stress tensor with some spin 1 operator. Beyond that, there's nothing I can tell you.
Because, I guess here it looks explicitly like it does depend on the kinematics. These are just the energies.
Yeah, so the OPE coefficient, what tends to come out in all these OPEs, and this has to do with the structure of this Mellin transform, is the Euler beta function, which, that's just something that is a theme in all these OPEs, where you put in operators with, general conformal dimension. And then in this limit and the one with the stress tensor, which also has no 1 over set to the 4 term, because you're taking the limit that your stress tensor guy is a dimension 2 operator, then the Euler beta function simplifies to something, and then, so for example, for T with J, or let's say O, you get H over Z minus W to the squared, plus 1 over, derivative, right? Plus 1 over Z squared term, but this H comes out when you take a particular limit of these conformal dimensions from the Euler beta function. So, yeah, I don't know what, so this is what has been worked out. Beyond that, it's not clear. Yeah, there's also a convergence issue for gravity amplitudes, and in particular the shifting of conformal dimensions has an effect on the convergence of amplitudes. Yeah. There's lots of subtleties. Okay, maybe I should sum up. So what I've been telling you is that if you want to understand a potential holographic structure of asymptotically flat space, maybe a good way to attack it is to go into a basis or a formalism that makes conformal symmetry manifest. The Lorentz group in 4 dimensions happens to be the global conformal group on the celestial sphere, so that's very nice. So we can label our operators by the conformal dimension and the spin. Universal properties of scattering amplitudes, like these factorization theorems, seem to carry over. Modulo some subtleties that have to do with the fact that asymptotic symmetries work in a certain way, in particular supertranslations work in a more funny way, but essentially there is a structure that persists in this conformal basis. You can find the Gaussian modes of spontaneously broken asymptotic symmetries as particular objects in this conformal basis. I didn't have time to talk about this, but you can also ask, so these asymptotic symmetries, they shift the fields, the gauge fields, and the matrix in a certain way, and this shift is related to memory effects. These memory effects, so we worked out this effect for the leading gauge theorem and gravity case in this conformal basis. The feature seems to be that to get a memory effect in this particular conformal basis, so that in the gauge that is used to get conformal properties, requires a combination of in and out states. So that's maybe a surprising feature. And then I've pointed out that there are further subleading soft theorems that have been related to subleading asymptotic symmetries proposed by Campilli and Lada, which have been argued to also give factorization properties of amplitudes for different values of these conformal dimensions. And there are further things that are being worked out. And let me just finish saying that this is just sort of scratching the surface or the tip of the iceberg. And hopefully there's much more interesting structure that resembles some structure that we know in CFT. And it would be really exciting to understand what the CFT is and what its properties are. And hopefully then by using techniques that we know from CFT, like bootstrap technique, we can make statements about bulk physics.
Further questions?
In this context, what would you consider to be the key difference between the gauge theory and gravity?
One is the convergence of amplitudes. So if you take, let's say, the MHB n gluon amplitudes that we talked about before, one thing. So when you do this Mellin transform of all the n external particles, what happens is that after you use your energy momentum conserving delta function, and you, let's say we do a four-point function, then at the end of the day, you will remain with one integral in one of the energies, which is a sum over all the, let's say n. This holds for n. Lambda I minus 1. In order not to introduce a cutoff and break conformal invariance in the UV or the IR, you can interpret this object as a distribution. So what you end up with at the end of the day is a function as is that looks like a normal correlation function in 2D CFT. Then there's a function in the other coordinates, the z-bars, which is a bit funny because it turns out that these are contact terms. So that's already something that's not, it's not a vanilla CFT correlator that you get. But on top of that, you get a remaining energy integral, which in Yang-Mills can be interpreted as a distribution. So at the end of the day, you have this times some distributions in, let's say, z-bar 1, 2, etc., and some normal correlation function in the other variables. Now, for gravity, what happens is that for three-point functions, you don't have this minus 1. For four-point functions, you have a plus 1, and so on and so forth. And so in principle, these are not convergent, strictly speaking. I argue that if you do an analytic continuation of some of these lambdas, shifting them by I, which is exactly what you had to do here in order to get this factorization to work, that then formally you can again interpret it as a distribution. So it's like if you wish a hack to make the celestial graviton amplitudes look again like graviton correlators. So I think that's one of the main differences here. There are others, but this is one of them, yeah.
I was just going to ask what happens in higher dimensions.
I don't know.
And it seems like the structure here is relying on a lot of stuff that's going to be specific to.
So I told you before, so the asymptotic expansion and the story about asymptotic symmetries is you impose some boundary conditions and then you have certain fallouts in R. If you're in high dimensions, you will not have like 1 over R. You can also have log terms, you kind of. So, I mean, yeah.
So it's worth
this has been done in a certain coordinate system, in a certain gauge. And then you get what you get. And then if you do something else in another dimension, you get. Some of the things have been worked out in higher dimensions, but yeah.
Did you say somebody also worked out just lambda phi to the 4? This Celeste lambda 2.
Yeah.
Makes sense.
With loop corrections.
And you still get these delta functions of lambda, like that part is?
I believe so.
Do you know if the OP satisfies crossing if you push, for example, unitary unitary S matrix into this machinery, does it get out good set of correlation functions that way?
Yeah, so we're getting a bit ahead of ourselves because this was done in like October. So yeah, there's lots of interesting questions, all kinds of questions that you can ask about CFDs. You can go here and say, okay, what happens?
But it's not known that it doesn't satisfy crossing, I guess, at this point.
Yeah.
Just going the other direction, what about lower dimensions? We have a celestial circle.
I also have nothing to say about that. What is this story in lower dimensions? So a lot of this was maybe motivated by this interconnection of different topics. Yeah, I have nothing useful to say about lower dimensions. Really, here the nice thing was that the Lorentz group acted as the global conformal group, and then you can label things, and then they look like CFD objects. Maybe they're a bit funny because their OPs are a bit funny, or central extensions are missing, but okay, we're in flat space, and yeah. Yeah, so it will be some kind of exotic CFD that's not a vanilla one.
Yeah. Okay, let's thank Andrea again.